Welcome to the Dropside News Tuesday morning live stream. I'm your host this week, Murtaza Hussein. I'll be joined later on by colleagues Ryan Grimm and then Sharif Abdul Qaddous and also Abu Bakr Abid. We have a really good show this week. We're going to be talking about a number of different things. First of all, the current ongoing war of economic sieges between Iran and the United States over the Strait of Hormuz. The war itself has settled into a kind of stasis where both sides are trying to inflict economic harm on each other to try to make the situation untenable for the other party. We have a guest coming on later, Brett Erickson. He's the economics and geopolitical expert, specifically on markets and so forth, to discuss the mathematics behind the siege and who's likely to prevail, and also the impact in global financial markets and oil markets from having this very critical waterway choked off for so long. There's a lot of, you know, impacts that people would not expect in global bond markets and so forth, which are affecting people in the United States and beyond, but are going to amplify as time goes on if the situation is not resolved decisively by one side or the other. So we're going to talk about that, and later we're going to talk with Abu Bakr and Sharif about the one-year anniversary of the killing of journalist Anas al-Sharif in Gaza, and the many, many journalists who've been killed in Gaza during the genocide over the past 3 years almost now. But first, I want to bring Ryan on just to chat a bit before we have Brett on. Ryan, good to see you.
Hey. Yeah, how you doing, Maz?
Yeah, good. So, you know, before we have Brett on, I want to talk a little bit with you just about the economic situation, both in the United States and globally. Now that we're settled into almost like a permanent standoff with Iran, or a situation which is a war or just short of war, you know, food prices in the U.S. have gone up. Inflation is going crazy in the U.S. Bond prices going up is going to affect the financing costs of everything. People refinancing their mortgages and so forth will be affected by that. And you know, there's not really a solution on the horizon, it seems. And there's a headline I was looking at this morning before the show started that the U.S. Strategic petroleum reserves have actually dipped to the lowest level in like four decades. These reserves are basically there for emergencies. They release huge millions of barrels of oil to the market to cool the markets and to make sure shortages and things like that don't happen in the case of a war. There was a major release for the Ukraine war, and now another one for the Iran war. And now it's under 300 million barrels, which would mean that if there's another release of 150 million barrels or so, it would come close to this level where it's almost dangerous to continue operating it, because it needs to have 70 million barrels to maintain some sort of structural stability in the actual caves where the oil is kept. So it seems like, you know, we're entering a situation where it's a lose-lose for everybody. I was kind of curious in your perspective as well, too, because Trump actually campaigned specifically on, you know, economic well-being for ordinary people in the United States and avoiding costly foreign entanglements. It seems to be completely at odds with that as we're heading into the midterms. And I imagine it's going to be something that affects people's, the way people vote, as much as the economy is suffering quite a bit now.
Yeah, he completely abandoned the entire premise of his comeback, other than retribution. His entire premise was eggs are too expensive, grocery prices are too expensive, inflation's out of control, Biden did this, I'm going to come in, I'm going to fix this, I'm going to make everybody's life a little bit easier, give you a little more breathing room. He has explicitly said he's not interested in that anymore. He calls this short-term pain for long-term gain. Last week, I believe, Brett knows these numbers a lot better than I do, something like 6 million barrels were released from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. He can get into those, into that with some more precision and talk about what that means long-term. I think one thing that I haven't seen kicked around much is, so people are wondering, yes, this is really, really bad. Like things are going terribly here in the United States, and much more so around the rest of the world. We're kind of cushioned more than almost any other country from the consequences of our own actions. But, and so people are wondering, like, why hasn't it gotten even worse? And I think there's a lot of kind of engineering that has gone on to arrange that. But I also think what people need to try to think back to is where things would be had this not happened. If you go back to February, mortgage interest rates and interest rates had come under 4%. Mortgage interest rates had come under 4% for the first time since spiking many years prior, which was starting to open up the housing economy. Like finally, people who had been locked into these, you know, very low interest rates that they had refinanced into during COVID were saying, okay, you know what? I can actually now sell my home. And because I can sell my home, then somebody else can buy the home. And so you've had, you know, for, you know, 7 years or so, effectively an entire generation of people locked out of the housing market. That was finally starting to thaw. You were seeing inflation coming down. You were seeing a real kind of economic rebound slash return to normalcy, and the trend lines were all in a, you know, pretty positive direction, except for all of the volatility and insanity caused by Trump's Liberation Day and the tariff policies, which hadn't quite buffeted the economy completely yet, because the world was hoping that this was just a phase that he was into, and it was gonna, you know, it was causing, you know, real damage, but it wasn't causing the kind it would if it stuck around permanently. And so if you imagine where the world would be and what prices would be like and what the economy would be like in a world, say, you know, 6 months later, where we did not go to war, I think the gap between that and where we are is much greater than kind of the gap between where we were in February, because things still sucked in February, hadn't quite gotten better yet. So I think that partly explains when people are saying, why haven't things gotten much worse? Well, they're much worse relative to where they would be if Trump hadn't completely derailed the process of this recovery and sent us off into this odd place. I see Brett is here because there's a lot going on underneath the hood, whether it comes to the collapse of the economy and so forth, that is interrelated here.
Yeah, absolutely. Brett, welcome to the show.
Absolutely. Thank you guys for having me here.
Yeah. So Brett, I've been following your analysis for quite some time during the war, actually. And it's very interesting because you've been able to fill in some of the math behind the numbers of the U.S.'s proposed strategies for economic warfare against Iran during the war. And before we get to that, I want to just let listeners know a little bit, or viewers know a little bit, that in the last 48 hours, there were some interesting developments regarding the possibility of a negotiated settlement to the war. It seemed like there were reports over the weekend that, you know, a deal might be at hand, and even Scott Bessent and other administration officials seem to be preparing the ground for some sort of concession on the Strait of Hormuz, or some sort of diplomatic solution that would open up the strait in some capacity. But after that, you know, based on allegedly, the U.S. moving the goalposts at the last minute regarding an agreement, the Iranian side released a very onerous, seemingly, list of demands for the U.S., on full lifting of sanctions, removal of all U.S. military assets from the region as a prerequisite to engaging in new talks on the situation. So front-loading their demands for an agreement at the beginning, and seeming to draw a much harder line and making the prospect of a negotiated settlement less likely. And there were some reporting, as I mentioned, that may have been a response to something happening behind the scenes in the talks on the U.S. side. And today, the Pakistani defense minister, who's not really a reliable source, to be honest, on these subjects, he said that a deal is still at hand, some peace agreements happening and so forth. It all seems very unlikely at the moment, or seems very ambiguous at best. But I did want to ask you something very particular, because, you know, me and Ryan were discussing before he came on the impact in global financial markets, global oil reserves and so forth. And it seems like it's a test of stamina between the U.S. and Iran, or the global economy really, and Iran now, who can last much longer. The strait is blocked for the most part. Iran is hitting ships coming out of the strait as much as they can, and the U.S. is doing this blockade on Iran. And it seems like they're trying to see where hyperinflation, or where inflation, or where general economic shortages and so forth will bite hardest. I'm curious your perspective on the U.S. strategy towards Iran at the moment, because they're trying to stop Iran from exporting oil, which is a major lifeblood of the economy. But there's a clock ticking on the U.S. side as well, too, for all the reasons me and Ryan were mentioning beforehand. Who do you think has more stamina or more leeway in the situation? And how do you think that siege strategy is likely to play out?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the key flaws with the blockade is a lot of it is meant to cut off those oil revenues. The issue is, in the first blockade, Iran had about 120 to 140 million barrels of oil outside the blockade line. And in May, the average price of Brent was about $117 per barrel. Iranian oil was selling at just barely a discount. So they're earning double what they had projected to earn at that time. As a result, through this month, they're ahead of schedule on their projected oil revenues. And that is definitely a huge aspect in their ability to weather this storm. And then we signed the MOU. And as a result, during those 27 days, Iran was able to export 80 million more barrels of oil, which is about 175% their normal export rate. So while eventually the blockade will bite, we're not seeing that in the rial. The rial has held better than it did prior to the war to the US dollar. And Iran's inflation rate has not meaningfully been impacted as a result of the blockade here. So we're just not seeing, from a data and numbers perspective, we're not seeing much to contribute to an imminent collapse of the Iranian economic infrastructure.
Just to clarify, Brett, if they were able to push 80 million barrels, export 80 million barrels during the 20 days that the MOU was in operation, how long will that, will those ships be out at sea docking and unloading their cargo such that it continues to bring in revenue even as the, even if the blockade is like 100% effective when it comes to new ships going out?
Yeah. I mean, that's a big part.
Are they all unloaded, weeks, months? Like, what are we talking?
Yeah. So, I mean, Iran, per their year 1405 budget bill, is only planning to sell oil at $55 a barrel. Right now, Iranian oil is selling at, you know, $5, $6, $7 discounts, but we're trading at, you know, $85 to $90 per barrel. So they're earning significantly more than they have been budgeting for. In addition, their average export rate is about generally 1.7 million barrels per day. So between those two, I mean, at $55 a barrel, at 80 million barrels, you're looking at 40 days. But when you're talking about selling it at, you know, $80 per barrel, you're looking at 3 months. The other important aspect is generally for Iranian oil sales, because of the need to launder those proceeds and evade sanctions, it can take 1, 2, or even 3 months for those revenues to hit the Iranian system so that they're actually usable for trade. So, I mean, you're looking at 4, 5, 6 months before those revenues fully dry up. And that doesn't even account for the roughly month and a half to 2 months ahead of budget that they are from being able to export and sell so much before the blockade was implemented. In fact, we even did a reverse blockade essentially by unsanctioning Iranian oil in March under a general license U, where they were able to sell free of sanctions. So they're ahead of schedule, and we just let them export 80 million more barrels that they're going to be able to sell at higher than market prices, or higher than budgeted prices. So, I mean, we're looking well into 2027 before those oil revenues actually freeze up. And I mean, then it only starts. I mean, then they're only at budget for that timeline, not even catastrophically below.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a really important point. I want to ask you something too as well, because at the start of the war, there was a fear, and actually it happened, that oil, Brent oil prices would go up to 120, 150, maybe even 200 if the strait remains closed. But somehow, you know, even though it's elevated, it stayed around the 80, 85 range at the moment, at least, and seems to be stable there, despite the fact that there's no political solution on the horizon, realistically, that we can see. And there's no strict possibility of militarily opening the straits. So all the blockages are still there. Why has it stayed at that relatively manageable level at the moment? And secondly, if the Iranians can go well into 2027 before these budgetary shortfalls really begin to bite regarding their oil sales, where might the global economy be, however, by that time, if the sieges work out that long and there's no solution to the strait or normalization of traffic there?
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is something that's really critical in understanding how the Iranians have approached this. And again, it's just not compatible with this group of religious extremists that are hell-bent on martyrdom here. I mean, they've been exceptionally pragmatic. And I think what needs to be understood is they don't have an incentive to escalate beyond what is necessary to win this war. After this conflict is over, their neighboring Gulf countries are not moving to Australia anytime soon. They're still going to be there. They're still going to need to work together and have relations with one another. So a big aspect of this, when we look at the global energy markets, is early in the conflict, the global energy markets were losing 13, 14 million barrels per day. Now you have Chinese imports down about 4.5 million barrels, which is coming back online, but has been a very large part of why global oil prices have not risen more extremely. But you also have this Omani route. And while it's certainly not 8 million barrels per day, like some U.S. officials want to claim, it is likely 4 or 5 million barrels per day that are transiting under Project Freedom through the Omani route. And that, when combined with the decreases in Chinese demand, when combined with the East-West pipeline, and when combined with the increase in global oil production elsewhere around the globe, there is not a significant drop in the amount of oil reaching the market as there was prior to the war. We're looking probably at 3 or 4 million barrels per day that are not reaching the market now, compared to 13 or 14 million barrels per day that it was early in the conflict. But what's worth noting is that very clearly Iran has the ability to much more severely shut down the Omani route, or to strike Gulf energy infrastructure. Or, I mean, the Houthis just earlier today sunk a vessel and killed, or they didn't sink the vessel, but they killed three sailors there in the Bab al-Mandeb. So the Iranians and their proxy networks have significant ability to escalate if they decide that they need to escalate, but they don't have incentive to over-escalate and cause unnecessary damage if they believe that they can win at the current rate that they're at.
And what's the, what does the math say about their ability to win at this current rate? If you're, if we're, the global economy is down 3 to 4 million, why can't the global economy then just kind of stumble along well into 2027?
Right. So, I mean, I think this is a huge aspect that's been misunderstood or miscommunicated in general, is it's not the U.S. economy versus the Iranian economy. If that's the case, of course, no American, or a very small amount of Americans, want this war to continue. But the U.S. economy could survive far longer than the Iranian economy. That's not what it is, though. It's the economies in Africa, the economies in Asia. When we look at Japan, when we look at South Korea, we look at India, we look at the fertilizer crisis in Africa. It's those versus the Iranian economy. It's a weak link global economies versus the Iranian economy. We can't just have a complete food supply shortage that takes place and gets tens or hundreds of thousands killed. And then just in the United States be like, well, we're fine. We're able to feed our people. So I guess screw you guys. No, I mean, it's a global economy, well, the weak link versus the Iranians.
If you're Trump, I can imagine Trump saying, well, why can't we? Like, why does Trump famously does not care, like,
I mean, I think this is a hard part about the economic warfare perspective as well, is we don't have a lot of ability to escalate. This is why we so far haven't really conducted bridge and power plant stay at scale. We haven't struck their oil infrastructure at scale, because if we do, Iran can escalate. But that doesn't change just because it's economic warfare versus kinetic military strikes. If it does actually get to the point that the time does become on Washington's side, Iran will just escalate. They'll just attack Gulf energy infrastructure or water desalination or other critical economic infrastructure across the Gulf region and turn the table. You can't believe that they're a group of ideological extremists and then also believe that they aren't going to go down in a pile of brass if push comes to shove. Those two positions just aren't compatible. So to believe that they would not escalate when the economic pain became so severe would just be a ludicrous belief. And then you would be discounting escalation dominance as a whole, which is at the very core of this entire conflict.
You know, Brett, also for people who maybe don't understand as well too, because, you know, to Ryan's point, they will say, well, if you destroy the Gulf, great, it's their problem. We'll try to improve fracking here or something like that, engage in autarky and so forth. Very unrealistic ideas, but that's kind of the retort by some of the Trump people that even encouraging these attacks and so forth and start the war. If there was catastrophic destruction of Gulf economies and infrastructure and so forth, what would be the knock-on effects to the global economy? And secondly, you know, you mentioned the weak link aspect as well, too. The last week, there was a very interesting intervention by the Treasury Department to help stabilize the Japanese yen and so forth. And Asia was very, very impacted much more directly by the closure of the Strait of Hormuz in the short term. What other dominoes may start following if this continues staying at this level of stasis? And if it does escalate, then, you know, what would be the implications for the U.S. economy and global economy to lose the Gulf and so forth, or have a significant damage there from the war?
Yeah, I mean, this is the danger that everyone is facing right now, is we're essentially spinning a roulette wheel of economic theory right now. I'd much rather just not be spinning that wheel and be in the status quo that we were prior to the war. But if the escalation spirals out of control in the Middle East, I don't think anyone can say what the effects would be. I think you'd be insane to believe that there wouldn't be an economic depression. But you also need to understand, when we look at economic depressions or even recessions, you know, I mean, people die from starvation during those times. People commit suicide from job loss and losing their homes during economic depressions. You know, when not enough energy is reaching the global markets, hospitals can't function properly and people can't get the necessary emergency care that they need, and they die. So there's a lot of death and destruction that comes with economic fallout. It is not so simply just, I can't afford to buy a new pair of shoes this month. It's that people will die and at a very massive scale. You also have to look at the humanitarian aspects. I mean, if we get to that point, we're looking at a total humanitarian collapse inside of Iran, which is 93, 95 million people, along with the entire Gulf. I mean, you're just spinning an economic roulette wheel of bad and worse outcomes. And this is, you'd be very hard pressed to be able to make the debate that is anything resembling a win. And who knows how that actually shakes out inside of Iran? Who's to even say that a total economic collapse inside of Iran, or even a change in government inside of Iran, is a better net outcome than what we currently have? I mean, they haven't developed nuclear weapons. They haven't, you know, nuked Washington, D.C. or Tel Aviv up till now. I mean, who's to say that we'd have a better outcome, or who's to even say that a total collapse would even reopen the Strait of Hormuz? I mean, we clearly see that it takes very little to stymie maritime shipping through the Strait. So you're just spinning a roulette wheel and crossing your fingers that it is not entirely catastrophic. And that's, I just think, not a remotely acceptable outcome, especially from the president, who has very publicly claimed to not want to be the next Herbert Hoover, and certainly would be.
What do we know about the physical economy inside Iran? And what do we know about the ability to get imports separate and apart from products that come through this Strait of Hormuz?
Yeah, so I mean, there's obviously a very large part of this, and what has been a lot of the pushback to the blockade, is they have land borders, and mm-hmm. people can fly in products as well, and they have Belt and Road Initiative rail lines from China and Russia. I mean, the ability, and they also have a huge domestic economy that is entirely self-reliant because of the 47 years of sanctions that they've been under. They've been forced to become very reliant on themselves. So from a food production standpoint, we've seen when bombing takes place inside of Iran, how quickly they're able to repair a lot of these roads and rail lines and bridges that have been taken out. They're very self-sufficient. And
what did the, what did the destruction of that, of the steel, their kind of massive signature steel plant do to their ability to make those kinds of rapid repairs?
I mean, not really entirely much. I mean, again, they're very self-sufficient. And again, it's problematic. I mean, there has been a ton of economic damage imposed on Iran as a result of the bombing campaign, probably 140, 150 billion there. And then also the blockade is probably causing $175 million of losses per day, which is a little broken because you're combining imports and exports there. But again, when you look at the inflation rate over the last month, it halved once the blockade was lifted under the MOU. When you look at the rial to US dollar exchange rate, under the MOU, it fell from 1.8 million to 1 prior to the conflict to 1.532 at the bottom of the MOU, which is obviously less than it was prior to the war. So it was a better exchange rate after the war ended. So you're looking at a lot of temporary economic pain. But then if they're getting 100 to 120 billion of frozen assets, they're getting ability to extract fees from the Strait of Hormuz, they're getting a reconstruction fund. They're coming out economic net positive in the long term and medium term, even the short term. I mean, if they get those frozen assets released, they're going to unwind almost all of the economic damage and then be able to have a lot more internal security, knowing that there's a very low likelihood that any future U.S. president would launch a war again against Iran. So they're really looking at just a very short timeline of pain. And when you're looking at like the bombing of the school children in Manab and threatening to wipe out their civilization and bombing their water infrastructure and threatening bridge and power plants today, you can't deny that there was a rallying around the flag or at least a total disenchantment of the view of the United States, where, again, they've suffered for 47 years. This isn't new to them. And now they have so much more belief in what had probably been viewed as propaganda of the great Satan. We killed 168 school children and teachers and threatened to wipe out their civilization. That's pretty great Satan-y behavior. To believe that they can't stand another 6 months or a year, you just would have a very hard time making that debate that they're just about to collapse at this point when the economic data just does not support that. And there is so much more steadfastness around the country of Iran right now.
This is my last question, but it seems like the U.S. theory of victory, as expressed by Trump recently, who said that the U.S. is going to be low-keying it, quote-unquote, in the war. So basically trying to get as much oil as you can out of the strait with the Omani route and then hoping that the siege eventually bites enough to either force the implosion of the Iranian society and economy or at least they force them back to the negotiating table on favorable terms, ostensibly opening up the strait with no preconditions and things like that. Do you think that they can get enough oil out of the strait on the Omani route? Is that a sustainable situation? Because I know normally there's about 20 million barrels that come out of the strait. The U.S. claims that there's 8 million barrels coming out from the Omani route. Open source intelligence suggests more like 3 to 4 million respectively. Is that enough to sustain the global markets? Like that sort of maybe quartering of the strait, would that is enough life support to keep things going for the next 6 months or year? Or do you think that that is an unrealistic for various reasons, in addition to the fact that Iranians may escalate and start hitting those ships a bit more?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it's twofold. So one, something that Rory Johnston just highlighted the other day is the outbound flows of vessels is about 3.5 times that of the inflow of vessels. So it's very temporary right now. There's able to be even whether it be 3 to 5 million or let's assume 8 million barrels per day moving throughout the Omani route. That's very temporary if there's not enough replacement vessels coming back in to then be able to continue that perpetually. And that is what we are seeing is there's 3.5 times the amount leaving that is entering. But what is worth noting is this is buying time. And I think that is why the premise that people are saying Iran is overplaying their hand is just fundamentally incorrect. Right now, I would argue that they are underplaying it by allowing that much to move through the Omani route. They clearly have the ability to strike. I mean, we see it with the Houthis. They sunk a vessel just last week entirely and capsized it. And then they killed three more sailors today on a Saudi vessel in the Battle of Mandeb. Iran can do the same, and Iran can escalate. And again, let's assume that they are unable to strike those vessels and shut that down. They're not just going to roll over and call it quits. They're just going to escalate and strike energy infrastructure across the Gulf. I mean, they're just not going to roll over and allow that to happen. But again, at the same time, they don't have incentive to over-escalate if they do not yet feel the need to. But you'd have a really hard time convincing anyone that they do not have the capability to more severely strike those vessels. Right now, it's been much more of a disabling tactic. They've proven the ability to kill sailors and to capsize vessels, and they can pull that lever if they need to. They just simply don't have an incentive to if they believe that time is on their side, which very clearly they do right now, and they believe that they can wait out Trump and they can get the concessions that they need. But if push comes to shove, they're just going to escalate. It's the same problem that it's been throughout any escalation option, military or economic or otherwise, throughout this entire war, is Iran holds escalation dominance. And that's something that we just fundamentally are incapable of overcoming without, again, spinning that economic roulette wheel that I don't think Trump is willing to spin, because it has no guarantee of actual victory, and it would make him Herbert Hoover.
I think you just answered a question that I've had, and I think we might have just lost Brett. But I had been wondering why was and Brett, I don't know if you lost this for a second. I think you just answered a question that I've had. I've been wondering why they were allowing, you know, such significant traffic to move through the Omani route when they didn't have to. But now that makes perfect sense. If you're a ship owner and your ships are stuck in the Strait of Hormuz, and the U.S. is making some offers to you about they're going to guarantee the safety of your ship, and maybe there are some, you know, behind the scenes, there are some offers right. that, like, we'll compensate you if this doesn't work out. Yep. Obviously, the insurers are not interested in insuring this, but we'll take care of it. Don't worry. And we're printing money to save Japan. Might as well print a tiny bit just to save a ship. Then as a ship owner, you're like, okay, like, it's either that or I just have this ship stuck there.
Exactly.
And I'm bankrupt in 4 months because I need that ship moving. This is a cash flow business. Now, once they're out, when Trump calls again, he's like, hey, can you guys roll back in and pick up another delivery and roll back out? I would imagine at that point, they're like, yeah, we have other business opportunities that don't involve the high likelihood of getting killed and sunk. So we're just
that's the issue too. Is like, if right now companies and countries are willing to take that risk, Iran will just kill sailors and sink a vessel, and then that becomes a very different risk calculus. Right now, Iran is more focused on disabling vessels. But once people start dying and once vessels start entirely sinking, you're going to see an even greater reduction of inflows because they don't want to be killed. So even if it's right now, you know, 3.5 times more exiting than entering, once if Iran feels the need to escalate, which is a key, if they feel the need to, which right now they don't, then you're going to see like a 7 times outbound to inbound rate. So it's just going to continue to decrease. It's just a risk management decision where right now it's not good. And clearly the United States is incapable of protecting vessels to a sufficient degree. But what happens when they start getting killed and vessels start being sunk entirely, which Iran clearly has a capability to do, then that's just going to shut down even more. So it's really just Iran doesn't have the need to unnecessarily escalate and unnecessarily deteriorate relations with other countries until they need to, and then they will.
Right. Makes sense.
Yeah. Brett, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a great, great to get your analysis.
Absolutely. Appreciate you guys having me here.
Okay, so next up we have our colleague Sharif Abdulqudus and our other colleague Abu Bakr al-Abid. We'll be talking about the anniversary of the killing of Anas al-Sharif. Sharif, welcome to the show.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, as we all know, yesterday was the one-year anniversary of the assassination of Palestinian journalist Anas al-Sharif. There were events and vigils yesterday held in Gaza. There were also protests and vigils held across the United States, including in front of the New York Times building yesterday in New York City. Anas al-Sharif and five other journalists were murdered by the Israeli military when they bombed a media tent outside of Shifa Hospital. And in a strike that they took credit for and proudly proclaimed had succeeded in assassinating Anas al-Sharif. The other journalists, four of them, were also with Al Jazeera. His colleagues, Muhammad Kreka, Ibrahim Zahir, Mu'min Alewa, and Muhammad Nufal, and another journalist from the media outlet Sahet, Muhammad Al Khalidi. Israel's murder of the entire Al Jazeera team in Gaza City came just as they were launching this full-scale invasion of Gaza City and was seen by the journalists still in the city, including, frequent dropside contributor Abdul Qadir Sabah, that it was a warning and a signal that Israel can eliminate the most prominent journalistic voice on the ground at the time in Anas al-Sharif and get away with it. And the day he was killed, Abdul Qadir was on the scene moments after as a close colleague of Anas al-Sharif, and really harrowing footage of his body being pulled out of the wreckage. He had emerged at just 28 years old as the most recognized Palestinian journalist that was still alive and still reporting from Gaza. And he had stayed in the north during the entire of Israel's genocidal onslaught and became a near constant presence on television and online. And he was, like many journalists, directly and repeatedly threatened by the Israeli military for many months. He would receive calls on his phone by Israeli army officers telling him to cease coverage, telling him to leave northern Gaza. He received messages and voice notes on WhatsApp from Israeli forces. They would send him a pin location of his location to show that they knew exactly where he was. They bombed his house in Jabalia and killed his father. The Israeli military spokesperson in Arabic would post videos online taunting him. And then in October of 2024, the Israeli military placed Anas al-Sharif and five other Al Jazeera journalists on a hit list and basically claiming that they were going to kill them. And they've now killed two of them, Anas al-Sharif and our colleague Hossam Shabet, who was assassinated on March 24th last year in a strike on his car in Beit Lahia. So there are over 260 Palestinian journalists who have been killed since October 2023 by Israel, which is an unprecedented number in modern history. And they've been killed by this military that is enabled, backed, armed, and funded by the United States and Europe. And these killings of journalists have continued through the so-called ceasefire that was put in place in October of last year. But to talk more about journalists in genocide, to remember Anas al-Sharif and other journalists, we're joined by Palestinian journalist Abu Bakr al-Abid. He was and is a frequent contributor to Dropsite. He provided some of our most essential coverage on the ground from Gaza. He made the very difficult decision last year to leave Gaza, and he's now based in Dublin, where he joins us from. Welcome to Dropsite, Abu Bakr. It's good to have you with us again. Can you first talk about this first anniversary of the killings of Anas al-Sharif and his colleagues and five other journalists in an airstrike on a media tent last year? What do you think is most important for people to understand about journalists working in Gaza and covering a genocide?
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be back. Well, there aren't any words to describe how the family of Anas al-Sharif feels, how his colleagues feel as well. And you probably all saw the vigil yesterday that happened in front of the place where Anas al-Sharif was murdered, where the journalists gathered. And I think the overall sentiment at the moment in Gaza is that journalists, after the killing spree has intensified over the past few months by the Israeli military, the killing spree of journalists, that the overall sentiment is fear, is panic, to go to rush to the bombed out scenes and to report in them. And honestly, because I left Gaza a year ago, I think it has become even harder for journalists to work or report freely, independently, and to go to the bombed out scenes, because the double tap strikes or techniques have been used repeatedly by Israel during these times. And we saw that in inside Nasser Medical Complex, when also a group of journalists were murdered. And it was the Israeli military denied it first, and then it said it was a Hamas camera. So it's pretty appalling what we're seeing at the moment. I think what I'm saddened most about regarding Anas Sharif is that he repeatedly called on international committees to protect journalists and international media organizations to protect him. He flagged up all these threats directed at him by Israeli military officers and by pro-Israel media personalities. But there was no response. I believe that the world failed him. And as well, Dahdour said in his op-ed yesterday in Al Jazeera English, he said that he was killed twice, once by the silence of the world, and the second time was by not achieving accountability against his murderers. And he's right. He's absolutely spot on. We haven't seen any response. The killing of journalists continued unabated since his killing. And when we are talking about Anas Sharif, he was truly the eyes of Gaza, the most popular Arabic-speaking journalist in Gaza, the one who covered northern Gaza. I think without him, we didn't have known anything about what happened in northern Gaza. The general's plan back in late 2024, the catastrophic famine levels in parts of northern Gaza, the destruction, the obliteration operations that have been used by or that have been carried out by the Israeli military in vast parts of Jabalia and Beit Lahia. We wouldn't have known anything about that, weren't it for the likes of Anas Sharif, who was one of the very, very few journalists and reporters to remain in northern Gaza. So it's a heartbreaking loss. And I think since his killing, we haven't seen as much coverage as when he was alive. So this loss is not just one that concerns Al Jazeera, it concerns the entire media or journalists community in Gaza and around the globe. But I don't believe that Western mainstream media and most of the Western media outlets, including the Arab media outlets, care much about it, because they have been regurgitating all this propaganda, believing Israel's talking points as if he was a literal Hamas or whatever operative, which wasn't proved at all. It was a baseless allegation that other media outlets took as fact. So we're talking about a massive loss.
Well, I think it bears repeating also, as you mentioned, the coverage by Western media outlets has enabled this killing to continue, especially in the case of Anas Sharif. We saw, you know, Reuters won a Pulitzer Prize for photography the year prior. And one of the submissions in that prize was a photo by Anas Sharif of Jabalia, this massive bombardment of Jabalia. And their coverage the day that he was assassinated repeated in the headline and in the lead Israel's claims that he was a Hamas militant. It did put denials, but then it said, you know, his employer, Al Jazeera, which is funded by the Qatari government, denies these claims. Then much further down in the article, it said that, you know, CPJ and the UN also find these claims unsubstantiated. But really, kind of shocking coverage for a reporter that helped it win its Pulitzer Prize. And also, I think, you know, a lot of the world has turned away from coverage of Gaza, firstly, because of a so-called ceasefire that the US and Israel have very much pushed to have it portrayed as an actual ceasefire. When in fact, you know, the killing has continued, but also because of the war in Iran and in Lebanon, attention has turned away. And I think actually the last time we had you on the live stream, Abu Bakr, was to talk about a journalist who was assassinated in April, Mohammed Washeh, who was a close friend of yours and a mentor. He was assassinated in an airstrike on his car west of Gaza City. And again, the Israeli military bragged about his killing. Just in late June, his younger brother, Ahmed, was also killed in a strike, I believe in Burij refugee camp. His brother was just 25 years old, and he was Muhammad's cameraman, right? He was also working for Al Jazeera. I believe he was the 12th Al Jazeera journalist to be killed. He would set up the shots for Muhammad. They worked together as a team. He took care of Muhammad's children after Muhammad was killed in April, and then he's killed in June. And the Israeli military again brags about it and claims, without even bothering to provide any supposed evidence, that he's a Hamas terrorist. You know, what kind of effect does this have on the journalist community in Gaza? And then I do want to ask you about journalists being fired and losing their jobs recently.
I think first it's important to note that when it came to Mohammed Oshah's brother, the only evidence that the Israeli military posted was him holding a gun and firing shots from a gun. And I think if you want to talk about this particular evidence, all Israeli journalists are legitimate targets and must be killed and must be assassinated. There wasn't a single proof that Ahmed Oshah was a member of any political or armed resistance group. There wasn't at all, but all these lies have been regurgitated all the time. Even when Zohran Mamdani honored him or paid him a tribute, there were attacks on him by the so-called UN Israeli ambassador and other Israeli officials that he wasn't a journalist, but he was an operative. And we have seen, like I've seen it myself on Instagram and other social media platforms, that Israeli journalists are actually embedded in with the Israeli military into parts of Gaza, which is illegal, which is an occupied piece of land. And they're holding guns and they're having, you know, these love fests with Israeli soldiers, and nobody talks about it. CNN, as I mentioned before in the last time, CNN hired an actual ex-Israeli soldier who posted a picture of herself on a tank. So I think the level of impunity, Israel is drunk on impunity to kill journalists. The levels of impunity that we have seen are absolutely astounding. And what hurts more, as you just mentioned, the way these journalists are being treated. And it becomes more hurtful and painful from a news outlet like Al Jazeera, whose own journalists have been murdered in Gaza, and they should have been the champions of the rights of the Palestinian journalists, as they have always portrayed themselves as such. So there have been 24 layoffs recently by Al Jazeera Arabic to 20 to journalists in Gaza, not only journalists but also photographers and cameramen, and there weren't any reasons clarified to those reporters. And one of them spoke out on this operation, which he believes to be something like a policy against Palestinian journalists, that if they don't die or if they don't get killed, Al Jazeera would fire them. That's in his own words. And Mahmoud Shalha, when we talk about him, he's the nephew of Anas Sharif, and he's just 22, 23 years old. He was born in 2024. He's the sole survivor among northern Gaza journalists. He stayed there in the north. I was talking to him quite repeatedly. I've been talking to him quite repeatedly over the past week since his since the decision he received from Al Jazeera. And he talked to me that he literally imperiled his life every time he was reporting for Al Jazeera with Anas Sharif. And one of the striking things that he told me, he said that, I believe if Anas Sharif stayed alive, they wouldn't have fired me. I think that there would be a different scenario. And he said to me, I was doing my work at around noon in quite a week ago, and then I received a call from Al Jazeera Gaza office, and they called me and they said, well, that I have been fired, and thank you for your service or for your work. And he asked for the reasons. He reached out to the administration in Qatar about to ask about the reasons, and no reasons were unrivaled for him at all. And he feels a lot of pain because his benefits or his benefit entitlements haven't been paid. He wasn't told that they would be paid. And, you know, we're talking about someone who has lost his home, who has lost several members of his family. All of his friends have been murdered in plain sight in front of his eyes. He doesn't have a house. He's just a young man trying to survive the days. And the fact that he told me a lot of the times that we were rushing to the bombarded places, risking our lives on an animal drawn cart, or walking, sometimes running in the streets, and we were bombed three times. We survived attacks multiple times, just to receive such an unfair decision. And I feel his pain. I think the way even he told me, like, the way he has been treated is completely inhumane. And when you're talking about these journalists who have been ground down by several media outlets, not only Al Jazeera, it kind of weighs you down with a lot of despair and disappointment at how, actually, which is the question that we need to ask Western media outlets, and every media outlet treats Palestinian journalists. And if we are just want to do sloganeering about Palestinian journalists and not giving them anything, then we shouldn't try on any media outlets, in my opinion, because these journalists have done the most extraordinary job in our lifetimes. I don't think there's any comparison to it. So it's very frustrating. And just one final point on that. Also, Al Jazeera English, previous Gaza crew who chose their safety over staying in Gaza, they were all fired without any reasons. All of them, and they are a staff, some of them who have worked for Al Jazeera English for many years, for over 10 years. And they covered the 2020 war in Gaza. They covered the numerous escalations and the Great Return marches in 2018. And they were subjected to this level of horror all the time inside Gaza, inside what we call an open air prison. Now it's a closed air prison. And then they were fired because they chose their safety. And if this means something, we can't really shy away from saying it. It means that Palestinian journalists from most media outlets are scapegoats. They're just people who can be sacrificed. But for white journalists with respect or any other type of journalist, they're more sacred for them. And it's very appalling and racist.
Yeah, Abu Bakr, when it comes to the amount of money that Al Jazeera was paying to these journalists, whether Arabic or English, to the journalists themselves and to their families, you know, it's a lifeline. To Al Jazeera, definitely, they wouldn't know they'd sneeze and lose more money than that in their executive offices. So it can't be as if they had a meeting to decide like how to tighten their budget, and they decided they had to fire all of these heroic journalists. Like the meeting that they would host would cost more for all of the different chauffeurs. And, by the time the meeting was over, they could pay for that entire budget. So that means something other than money is driving this. Do you get a sense that some of this is being driven by them trying to cater to the Trump administration or Israel? Or what's your sense of what's going on?
I believe so. The way, because I've been I've been following closely up on Al Jazeera English, particular coverage of the genocide in Gaza. Al Jazeera English ran coverage of Gaza in the first month or 2 months of the genocide, saying it's an Israel-Hamas war, and they were trying to water down their statements and to tone down their language when it comes to covering Israel's war crimes and what they're doing in Gaza. And I think it's quite infamous because I believe the U.S. Sphere of influence over Al Jazeera and Qatar is very large. It's very gargantuan indeed. And we all know that what the Qatari relations with the United States are like. So I believe there has been, like, that the coverage of Al Jazeera, the reporting of Al Jazeera on Gaza has been meddled with by the United States. I do believe in that. And because if you see Al Jazeera English in particular, how they have been reporting this genocide, it tells you a lot that, or it raises the questions about what you have just mentioned. But you're right. Like, I don't, the budget or the budget wouldn't be much affected if those journalists were stayed and were reinstated. It wouldn't affect them in the slightest. And I don't know, like, the reasons are completely mysterious, except for the fact that it is a racist, as I said, appalling decision that nobody can understand or comprehend.
I think there also might be just a degree of callousness that, you know, from what I've heard also from people inside Al Jazeera, is that, oh, there's not that much coverage that we need from Gaza now. People are not that interested anymore. There's a quote-unquote ceasefire. Iran is happening. We don't need these reporters. And they just fire them summarily. It could be something deeper, that there's pressure, and there always has been pressure on Qatar, including during a blockade by Saudi Arabia and Bahrain and Egypt several years ago. One of their primary demands on Qatar was to curb Al Jazeera's coverage. We don't know if that's happening behind the scenes or not, or what's playing into this. But what we do know is that, yes, these Palestinian journalists who have performed this heroic task of covering this war, of covering this genocide, have now been cut loose, and their sole livelihood for them, for their families, for they're really supporting many, many people around them, has been cut off. I also wanted to ask, you know, a lot of people don't talk about, you know, there's over 260 journalists killed, but so many journalists have been wounded, have been, and are not covering anymore. And journalists who have been forced to leave Gaza and are also not able to cover Gaza anymore. And I wanted to ask about your case also, Abu Bakr. Part of the reason that you left Gaza, you made the very difficult decision that, you know, we were speaking about for a long time, was you were suffering very deeply from malnutrition, and your life was beginning to be in danger. And also you were afraid, because journalists were being so targeted, that you were putting danger on your family, because journalists' families were being killed alongside them as they were being hit. But on this issue of malnutrition, you are still suffering the health effects of the malnutrition that you had in Gaza. Can you talk a little bit about that and how it's still lingering, actually?
So last month, I was diagnosed again with hepatitis A virus, which happened to me in Gaza during the genocide and before the genocide in 2022. And when I came here to Thailand, although I was examined, my full body was examined, there were no marks of the disease. So suddenly I started feeling very fatigued and very malnourished and very fragile. So I went to the hospital, and then the hospital asked me to stay in the hospital for 2 nights. And then they found out that I'm still suffering from symptoms of hepatitis A virus and from malnutrition, so that I needed to take care of myself, eat more, and go on a diet that would help me recuperate in the best way possible. And it was very depressing for me. I think I didn't expect that after almost a year from leaving Gaza, since leaving Gaza, that I would pick up these issues again. I know they are recurring, and I'm actually in my last 2 weeks of recovery. I haven't recovered fully from it yet. And it is something that has really devastated me over the past few weeks, and I was talking to you Sharif about it and about the treatment process. And it's no surprise, but I'm not as much saddened by my disease as by those in Gaza, by the diseases that people are suffering from Gaza. You're talking about thousands who are still stuck in the territory, who want to be treated outside, who want to get outside for treatment, but they are being denied by the Israelis. And I don't know why they're being denied. Children are dying every single day. They're succumbing to their wounds, to their diseases. And they don't have some kind of reprieve at all. They don't have a way to get out of Gaza. There are so many draconian restrictions on the movements of these patients outside Gaza, of these genocide-wounded people outside of Gaza. And I really want to mention something, if you allow me, on probably it's quite related to the American politics and what is happening right now. And that's why I doubled down on this point probably in the past, that it's very important, it's very notable that under the Biden administration, that children from Gaza were being evacuated to get treatment in the United States. And we have seen this increasing from a time to a time during the Trump, during the Biden administration. But when Trump came into power, now there aren't any children getting evacuated into the United States hospitals. There aren't any families, any students who are, despite the fact that they are given scholarships by United States, by American universities, but the U.S. administration denies them visas and they can't really go to the United States. So there's also... probably, I know Biden and I know Trump and what they stand for, but there's also a better side of the Democratic Party, that Palestinians were allowed to go to the United States and were allowed, despite their both parties' complicity, that they were allowed to go to the United States to receive the treatment they wanted. And there are actually, from the Biden administration, thousands of children, probably hundreds, maybe thousands, I actually don't know, but there are hundreds of amputated children who are now being treated inside the United States hospitals. And that is very important. But since the Trump administration, this hasn't happened at all. It happened first in drips and drabs, but then it hasn't happened at all, was cut off completely. So there are many aspects to this. And I receive pleas every time from people in Gaza for their children to be evacuated because they're suffering from these signs of malnutrition and patches of other diseases and viral infections, but they can't get evacuated. They need agreement from third parties or countries in Europe, but they are not getting it. And now what my understanding, because I've talked to people and students and to patients' families in Gaza, that they are now even putting more restrictions on families in Gaza because they believe that there's a ceasefire ongoing, that the situation is getting better, that the healthcare system has restored its kind of normalcy in Gaza, and that people can receive treatment inside Gaza's precarious and decimated healthcare sector, which I find appalling. So, as I just said, we're getting back to the same point, that there is an unbelievable degree of racism and, as you said, rightly said, Sharif, callousness and supremacy, I would believe, against and discrimination against Palestinians, whether they're students, wounded children and families, or any other part of the society.
You know, Abu Bakr, despite everything, there's still some journalists who are still in Gaza dealing with these conditions, Israeli attacks, and being part of the suffering of Gazans in general, famine, disease, and so forth. And you yourself, as Sharif mentioned, experienced a lot of this. Can you talk a bit about what it's like to be a journalist and being subject to displacements and lack of hunger and still having to find a way to work in those conditions, and what people who are still reporting from Gaza may be experiencing today?
I mean... I'm short of words when it comes to describing these conditions. When I was in Gaza and I was talking much to Sharif and Ryan and Jeremy and about the conditions, and every 5 minutes, literally, there was a nearby or an adjacent airstrike. And we reported much on this, on the cop bombing of parts of Deir al-Balah, the invasion of eastern Deir al-Balah. And a lot of these things were happening like quite 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers from where I live. And besides that, it's very like people don't understand and won't understand until they get into Gaza and see and meet Palestinian journalists and how they operate inside the pulverized territory themselves, what they are doing and how they're reporting. Most of these journalists have families. They have families to take care of. They have families to provide food and water for, and they are living in dilapidated tents. Even the workplaces where Palestinian journalists are working in Gaza are actually tented workplace. It's made from flimsy, leaky tents. So when it's winter, they are drowning in water and floods, and their tents are blown away. When it's summer, they are it's scorching heat and they can't bear it. So that's life for them. They have families to take care of, and then you have these layoffs from these media outlets. So how can they continue to survive? Not only that, but some of the journalists who live on the eastern outskirts of the entire Gaza Strip are forced to leave as Israel continues to expand its occupation of Gaza, particularly from the eastern side of the Strip or from the eastern regions of the Strip, that this expands to where they live, especially in Al-Zaytun neighborhood in Gaza City, in central Gaza's Al-Buraij, Al-Maghazi, and Al-Maghazi refugee camp, and parts of Deir el-Balah, and more to the eastern outskirts of Khan Yunis, like Ambassan and Akhsa'a. Some of these journalists are living there. So when Israel expands its occupation of Gaza, they have to leave their homes, even if they have homes in the first place, and they have to move and relocate to another place. And besides all of that, it's also very significant to know that even if they want to get their money out from their banks, either cash or pay by card, which has become a recent frequent transaction among Gazans when the ceasefire took effect, the so-called ceasefire took effect. But when they want to withdraw cash from the banks, the banks are overwhelmed. They are inundated with hundreds, but even thousands of people. So they can't get the cash out to continue the work and to continue their operations. And as a matter of fact, they're using people like I talked to more of them, to so many of these journalists, they're using old phones. Like you're talking about Xiaomi, which is a Chinese company, a phone that was created in 2012, or somebody else using a Samsung phone from 2010, or somebody using a camera that dates back to 2010, even before. So they're using the same like equipment that they have got hold of for many, many years. And it is, like, as I said, it is appalling. There's not much pressure. I think Ryan and I were talking about something that I'm completely imposing to allow like international journalists to get into Gaza, but now I have completely changed my opinion. The fear that has been sparked among Gaza journalists to report on the situation. I know Western reporters, mainstream media reporters are biased for Israel, towards Israel, but now the situation has been upended. I think now we need them, because if you have journalists in Gaza who are very worried about their lives and the lives of their families, and they have everything to lose right now. I know Gaza is decimated and obliterated, but they can't afford to lose more journalists. There are a few journalists who deserve, like, who are very much needed now to survive. So there has to be more pressure from international media organizations on the Israeli military and the Israeli government to be allowed into Gaza. But we haven't seen even this sincerity, I would say, to get into Gaza and amplify the voices of people in Gaza. So I think I have changed my opinion completely after what I've heard from people. Like, I have advised journalists in Gaza to go and cover some stories. And they've told me, no, we're not going to do it. It's a dangerous place, and mm-hmm. we know what's going to happen. So if Israel would probably back down a little bit if it is a white journalist going to that place and covering the story. But if it is a Palestinian journalist, their lives don't matter anymore for them. Like, they can target anyone, they can go after anyone, and it doesn't make any difference. But I'm sure, like, journalists in Gaza are more than willing to help, Western journalists to cover stories in Gaza. But I think it's now the time more than ever. It is the time more than ever.
Abu Bakr, just one final question. And going back on this issue of visas, as you mentioned, the Trump administration issued a blanket ban on any Palestinian receiving a visa to the United States. And of course, that affected medical evacuations too. The U.S. wasn't taking many medical evacuees, but they did take some. And you know, those were significant. But you're now based in Ireland, and you had a piece recently in Electronic Intifada talking about how Ireland now is restricting visas for students from Gaza. These are students who have already received fully funded scholarships to Irish universities and are now not being granted the visas. Can you talk about what's happening in Ireland?
Yeah, so I'm just going to start with a new update because I have received a reply from the Justice Minister or Justice Minister's office, and he noted that, well, there aren't any special arrangements for Palestinians, nor will be, nor like will be in the near future for Palestinian students or Palestinian nationals to come into Ireland despite what they call the humanitarian crisis. And I am astonished by the double standards here, because in 2022, the Taoiseach of Ireland, which means the Prime Minister of Ireland, Micheál Martin, who's right now also the Prime Minister of Ireland, he issued a statement back in 2022, shortly after the war between Ukraine and Russia broke out. He said that Ukrainian citizens, and I'm quoting him, the Ukrainian citizens, to be visas for Ukrainian citizens to be waived because of the humanitarian situation, and that this situation would trump anything. But now you can see yourself what the response looks like, that there won't be any special arrangements for Palestinian students, and they are treated as any other student or like any other students from around the globe. And it's quite interesting because last year, according to the stats in Ireland, Ireland has accepted over 40,000 international students, and most of them come from India. And those are privately funded scholarships that the Indians come on or are accepted onto. The same with Palestinians. Most of the Palestinian students who have been who have traveled to Ireland over the past 2 years in particular, because these evacuations have happened in coordination with the Coast Guard, the Israeli military's special unit on the borders, and with the Foreign Affairs Department and with the Jordanian officials. And it tells a lot. It actually tells a lot that, like, if you look at how these Palestinian students are being treated, and we have looked at the rejection letters, like, these Palestinian students are also privately funded. They are have been accepted into fully funded scholarships. The ones who have been accepted into fully funded scholarships, state-funded scholarships, have been granted visas. The others were not, because they're privately funded by external donors or private donors. It is the same story with Indians, Brazilians, Americans even, and other students. And the reason they're being denied, spelled out in the rejection letters, that they have to account for the gaps in education, as she said, like, as the office of the Justice Minister wrote to me in his reply, that he is acutely aware of the humanitarian crisis. But if he is, then he knows that Gaza universities have been annihilated, that there's not a single standing university inside the Gaza Strip at the moment, which doesn't seem that he's acutely aware. They're asking them to provide financial proof. And I don't know how audacious it can be for someone to ask people in Gaza who have been starved to death, who have been bombarded during the past 3 years, to provide financial proof of thousands, tens of thousands of euros. And they're asking them to show family circumstances, to show proof of family circumstances. And these people, like, I saw one of the rejection letters, and one of the women, the female students, she wrote in her visa application that she left in a tented city. And I don't know how they have asked her for a proof of family circumstances. And above all of that, they're asking them to show strong obligations to return to Gaza, and Gaza, at least if the reconstruction process or the recovery process starts now. It needs more than a decade at least to get back on its feet, but that's not the case for them, for the Irish immigration officials. And they're putting these stringent, they're imposing these stringent, draconian restrictions and requirements on the students to just push them away from coming to Ireland. And there has been a protest, which was very heartbreaking to see, in Gaza City by some of these students calling on the Irish government to allow them to come to Ireland this month. Now, I have heard early in the morning from local sources that there will be a cohort of students evacuated during this month on the 24th of August, if the Israeli military doesn't block it. But these students, there hasn't been any information revealed whether or not the students are those who are privately funded or state funded. So things are quite murky at the moment, but I believe all these instances, as I just said, the way they treated Ukrainian citizens and the way they are treating Palestinian citizens, including Palestinian children who have been wounded during the genocide, is really, really outstandingly appalling.
Yeah, Ireland is, just one quick follow-up there. Ireland is, famously, in the abstract, very, pro-Palestine. But what are the politics like domestically on the ground when it comes to, Palestinians who are in Ireland? And is there kind of some xenophobic pressure that is on these officials that is pushing them to be more restrictive? Like what's driving this? Because I think people who are watching are like, wait a minute, I thought Ireland was one of the best countries in the world when it comes to supporting, Palestinian rights and dignity.
There's an enormous level of lobbying on the Irish government to submit to the United States demands, in particular, and to the Israeli lobby. And this was crystal clear in different trains of events during the past 3 years. Particularly, I remember one of the most striking events was the renaming of Herzog Park. And Herzog was the sixth president of Israel. He was who's responsible for the expulsion of over 250,000 people in the occupied territories. And he was also responsible for the killing of hundreds of Palestinians in those now occupied villages. And the motion was going to be passed by Dublin City Council. And everyone agreed on that. The people wanted that. The people are very supportive of Palestine. They have shown an unwavering level of solidarity since the genocide broke out. But then there was one objection tweet from one of the American officials and one of the Israeli officials. And then the story went viral and the pressure grew massively on Ireland, on the Irish government. And then the Prime Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, Simon Harris, released the statements or issued the statements that they are very, quote, appalled by this motion and that Herzog represents Ireland's history and Ireland's history. We know that it has taken a neutral position for many, many years since their freedom. And then the motion was cancelled, immediately cancelled it was. And not only that, it's also across different, over past times, it's also been reported in the journal, in the local news outlet journal and in the Dutch as well, that Ireland deliberately allowed the United States to deport Palestinian nationals from the United States, and they were shackled on the airplane and they were handcuffed and they knew that they didn't do anything, and the airport was used, their airways were used as if nothing was wrong with that. And we also know that Ireland also recently in mid-2025 and late 2025 paid over 10 million euros in 10 million US taxes for air traffic for military jets, US military jets that carry weapons to Israel. Also, Ireland, it was reported that it has paid millions of euros in military exports for Israel during only 2024. So actually, it's as somebody, one of the professors that I talked to, it's a myth of solidarity. The Irish government, despite without the pressure from the people, I think it would be as much as the UK or as much as the United States. And Ireland is in fact a settlement for the United States. It's a US settlement. Whatever, like the level of investments by the United States in Ireland is unbelievable. And the way its politics are is being controlled by the United States is also unbelievable. Even when it comes to the occupied territories belt, they just removed the services from the bill, which constitutes over 70 or nearly 70% of the bill. So it still gives Israel legitimacy. Ireland is the second major trading partner with Israel with tens of millions of euros. And you can see Israeli products here and in almost every shop in Ireland. There are also 75 Irish citizens who have served in the Israeli military during the genocide, as it was declassified by the Dutch. So if you want to talk about the Irish government's complicity or the Irish regime's complicity, I would believe we need hours and hours. It's pretty appalling, and it's very complicit and has blood on its hands. As much as it's a microcosm of the UK government and other Western governments, it's complicit, definitely.
Well, Abu Bakr, thank you so much for all your work and for all the work you've done for Dropsite and all the work you continue to do, and for your voice and for speaking out. And I want to remind people that as yesterday was the anniversary of Enes's assassination, we posted yesterday for the first time some audio of Enes Shadif. We sent him a series of questions back in September of 2024, and he sent me back a 10-minute voice note, and we published excerpts of that. If you want to read the full transcript, it's also linked. You can see that on our Instagram at dropsidenews.com. And that does it for the show. But Ryan, there's a bunch of primaries today in Michigan and Wisconsin, where Palestine, you know, has always been a key issue in Democratic primaries. But what's happening with our coverage with that? And you're doing a live stream tomorrow.
Yes. So tomorrow, we're Maz and I are doing something with Eli Lake, or not Eli Lake, Eli Clifton, right? Sorry, Eli. His new book on the Israel lobby. It's for Dropsite premium subscribers, or whatever you would call it, people who are paying to support Dropsite. We'll post it. You know, we'll post the full thing later. But if you want to be there live, you know, just go to dropsitenews.com and sign up to get to become a subscriber and support the work we're doing, and then join us at 7 p.m. tomorrow night. Yeah, today, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and South Carolina all have primaries. Interestingly, South Carolina, I got Matt Lynch or Mark Lynch, I forget his first name, is running in the Republican primary. This is to finish the term of Lindsey Graham. He recently has been running kind of against AIPAC, saying I'm the only candidate in this race in South Carolina that is refusing AIPAC money. He ran against Graham in the previous primary, and I think he got 29% of the vote, which is pretty respectable for for how long Lindsey Graham had been in the Senate. It's now a multi-way primary with his sister Darlene Graham running to replace him, who has Trump support, but there are other Republican candidates who have some base of support as well. Darlene, interestingly, said, my brother, I will admit, was obsessed with war and national security and foreign entanglements, and that would not be how I would engage as a senator. Kind of an interesting kind of slight rebuke of her late brother. But it'll be interesting to see how Lynch performs in the South Carolina primary running against AIPAC. If he can hold that 29% and the rest split the rest of the vote, that it could be a very interesting, kind of stunning result for Republican voters there in South Carolina. In Minnesota, Peggy Flanagan has been kind of refusing AIPAC money. She's the lieutenant governor, Native American woman, who has been a relentless kind of populist and critic of Israel. She's running against Angie Craig, who has the very unsubtle endorsement of the Democratic establishment, kind of a center-right house member. So that those two are neck and neck. Angie Craig has had tens of millions of dollars in dark money spent to prop her up. It's similar in its dynamics to what we saw in the Michigan Senate race, but has gotten just a fraction of the attention. But if Flanagan has the support of Bernie Sanders, et cetera, so if she wins, that'll be quite interesting. There's also a very hotly contested race to replace Angie Craig in the House between a guy, Matt Klein, who has the support of hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of AIPAC bundling, plus millions of dollars that appear to be from pro-Israel donors, floating through these various, front vehicles, against two other candidates, Matt Little and Kiana Berg. So we'll be watching that one closely as well. And then, of course, we have Wisconsin, where centrist Democrats are absolutely panicking at Fran Hong's surge. Like this candidate who, in a previous environment, would have no chance whatsoever, and she has just steamrolled her way through opponent after opponent that they've tried to put up to stop her. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. Her race has triggered this interesting conversation online about the kind of end of wokeness. I don't know if you guys saw this thing, the interview where she was asked about her previous comments saying that she wanted to cancel Thanksgiving, which is kind of almost a overly cliched like instance of woke one overreach. And she sort of stood by it, and the whole world kind of came down on her. And she's like, all right, never mind. Of course, I love Thanksgiving. Everybody loves Thanksgiving. Yes, it's rooted in its own genocide, but we all love Thanksgiving. And AOC was asked about that, and she also laughed it off and said, we all said some crazy stuff back
then.
She
said woke one was crazy,
which is, she was quoting the New York City Councilman, Chiose, who's what? He's Queens, is that, or Brooklyn?
He's Bed-Stuy.
Bed-Stuy. Yeah. And so there's this interesting moment where that wing of the Democratic Party is running on the moral authority that was accrued during that period, sticking with a lot of the substance, yet trying to distance itself from some of the stuff that's more electorally difficult for them to run on now, while yet not quite ever acknowledging that it ever happened. Like, we're kind of getting a denouncing of cancel culture from some elements of the left before they've ever actually acknowledged that it was ever a thing, which is kind of a funny kind of gap to try to live in. Like, you're denouncing a thing that you won't quite acknowledge ever existed.
I think Abdullah Saeed said something the other day that in regards to Hassan Piker and someone asking him about it on CNN, that we don't want to go back to cancel culture of that period. So again, acknowledging that something bad had happened, but without the full, I guess, debrief or something. I propose a jubilee or like a mass amnesty for all cancellations, 2020, 2023, that period, and all crazy statements maybe, but I don't know, that maybe we're not there yet. Maybe you can attribute to COVID or something as well. But
The deal has to be that if it's a full jubilee, that okay, we will wave away and give a hall pass to you saying that we should cancel you for going to a Mexican restaurant and doing cultural appropriation. Like, if you said that, we're giving you a jubilee for that, but you then have to allow the gym trainer who was fired for, I think Unheard had something about a guy who was running a trivia contest and mispronounced Nicaragua and was fired. Like, that guy has to be allowed back into society if you can be forgiven for your tweets about sushi being cultural appropriation or whatever. I think that could be a fair grand bargain jubilee.
Well, I think most people forget that the biggest cancel culture for years and years and years was of anti-war voices, but mostly, more than anything else, the Palestine exception. Yeah. I mean, if you said anything about Palestine, you would be canceled. And by all these free speech, so-called free speech absolutists, you know, your Bill Maher's and the Barry Weiss's and all of this, they were the prime people doing this canceling of pro-Palestinian voices. So it's kind of ridiculous. And also, you know, yes, there was what we call cancel culture, but it's also a movement that's contending, you know, with decades of police brutality and police killing black people. And finally, we're having these discussions and there's some accountability. And the moment there's some accountability, the backlash is so vicious that it's now being apologized for. And yes, we have to contend with maybe there was overreach, but I think, the backlash is worked in a way.
And Ryan, to Sri's point, you mentioned this woke too. This much worse is the anti-Palestinian, enshrining in laws. They're using legal measures to expel people from the country. They're doing terrible things. It's really authoritarian. And they're putting a far worse form of ideological censorship on people on this subject. And it's still escalating as we go on right now. So it is very grave.
Right. Cancel culture as it related to Zionism, pro-Palestine voices never went away. And now it is kind of becoming, woke too. Haverford, I don't know if you saw this deal at Haverford College, or is Haverford a college or university, whatever it is, Haverford has put out, reached some sort of settlement where they insist that any criticism of Zion, like, I think their statement is Zionism is an essential part of Judaism. And therefore, any discrimination or criticism of a Zionist is, punishable under school rules. So, I'm sure they've probably already banned, Students for Justice in Palestine at Haverford. But if they hadn't, SJP would have to say, sure, we would welcome people who completely disagree with our organization into our organization. Otherwise, they're all expelled. Mandatory annual trainings on anti-Semitism in a way that does not apply to any other group, they're uniquely having these annual trainings. So whatever woke one was, and however many excesses there were, it never got remotely that institutionalized into the apparatus of the state and the institutions itself.
Are you now, or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party? I mean, there was, I forgot where I heard this on a podcast, but someone citing the premier McCarthy scholar and saying, comparing the two eras and saying, this is much, much worse, actually. This is much worse, and it's happening on an institutional level, it's happening on a government level, and it's much more vicious. I think,
and on the on the right,
and all of this talk of woke debate, I wish some of these candidates would actually raise this instead of kind of going on the retreat so much.
And there's a renaissance of McCarthy himself on the right. There's a revisionist element now that is saying
Rubio that McCarthy cited him, did he?
Yeah, that McCarthy was right. We need more McCarthy. In fact, there was an executive order or some kind of presidential finding recently that cited McCarthy as an example of a positive example of how anybody associated with Cuba or the left needs to be treated now. Yeah. At the same time, if you're running in a swing state, saying that you want to cancel Thanksgiving is just as a matter of fact. Not going to fly.
Right. Well, thanks so much, guys, for joining Sharif and Ryan. And thank you, everyone, for our viewers for joining this week as well, too. You can catch us every Tuesday at 9:30 a.m. on the live stream. And as Ryan mentioned, tomorrow you can see a special event for subscribers to Dropsite on a new book, Israel's Lobby by Eli Clifton and Ian Lustig. I'm reading the book right now. It's absolutely fantastic. It's not even a sequel, I would say, to John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt's Israel Lobby book, but something diagnosing the far more extreme conditions that exist today, in which Sharif and Ryan myself were just discussing regarding Israel's influence on American institutions and U.S. foreign policy, and even domestic policy and the legal regime in the country as well, too. I do encourage people to sign up, subscribe, and join us for that event. And again, you can catch us every Tuesday, same time, same place. And you can see a lot more coverage by Dropsite in the week to come as well. Thank you again so much for joining us. And we'll see you again 1 week from now.